evening and welcome. It's my pleasure to bring the lesson this evening. I need to be quick to add, in case we have some visitors, that I am not, I say again, not the preacher for this congregation. We have, we have two excellent pulpit preachers. They have the background, education, training, and experience, and we appreciate them, we love them. Tonight was going to be our polka's opportunity to bring the lesson, and he had something come up he needed to tend to, so I said, well, I'll fill in for you. And it won't hurt me to have the practice if you can accept the abuse. I think this is the point where I'm supposed to say how many of you are current or reasonably so on your daily Bible reading or something like that. I don't have that tone and the timing that Chris does, and I'm not going to try to fill his shoes, so don't worry about that. But I do have the advantage. I have never prepared a lesson when in the back of my mind I didn't know that I was going to learn more in the preparation of that than the listener would learn from hearing it. But hopefully maybe you can derive something from this evening's lesson. I've had a couple of self-imposed Bible, I don't want to call it Bible lesson, Bible searches in my time. One of them we'll get to, with the lesson of the evening will come from Ephesians, the 4th chapter. I remember one of those self-imposed searches came from an experience, and I think all of you have probably had a similar experience. You hear something or you read something that just grabs you. It sounds so wise. It sounds so penetrating. You wonder, why didn't someone say that before? Why haven't I heard that before? Why isn't somebody saying that over and over? That type of thing where it just resonates with you. It stays for a while. And some time ago, I was reading about a very interesting historical personality. I enjoy when something comes up with his name involved and following through with it. A gentleman that was alive and active and doing his thing during the American Revolutionary War period. But he wasn't here. He was in England. He was a fellow that seemed to be ahead of his time. Edmund Burke was his name. In fact, I've heard Chris a time or three refer to him or some of his quotes in sermons. And Mr. Burke, he served in the Parliament of England and was a very high-profile fellow. He was a writer, a historian, a politician, and he told King George III, he said, you know, you and your followers need to leave these colonies alone over there. They want their independence. They're a little feisty. Let them have it. We don't want to fight with those people. They can go on and do their thing. We'll make friends of them. They'll help us. We'll help them in the future probably. But we all know that King George and his followers did not heed that advice. We know the rest of that story. But Edmund Burke was such an interesting fellow. And I heard a quote that he made in 1798 one time, and it goes like this. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. When I heard that, I thought, now that guy is smart. That is so wise. And the way he phrased that, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil, when you hear that much of it, you say, now I got to hear the rest of this. Just the one thing necessary for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing. So I dwelled on that a while, and boy, that's clever. That guy really knows what he's doing. What a brain he must be. And I knew in my own mind that the Bible had to treat that subject someplace. The Bible would address that. I just knew. So I started a search. It wasn't a project. It was, you know, thumbing through the Bible. You start with the concordance and you go through that. Then that one didn't work. So you find another version or translation and you go to that concordance, trying to find where the Bible addresses this heavy, penetrating thought that this man had. Those are things we think the Bible would address. And it just, the man's expression sounded like it was a biblical proportion. So I looked and it went on and on and on. I don't know how long I searched from time to time for that expression in the Bible. And it was frustrating. I thought, well, the Bible really doesn't cover that. Edmund Burke's come up with something here that falls in a crack, and the Bible's not interested in that. And then finally I found it, and it was right under my nose. And you may be ahead of me. It was a Great Commission. And of course, we know from the closing verses of Matthew and the closing verses of Mark, where Christ tells us of the Great Commission, go into all the world, preach the good news to all creation. Whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whoever does not believe will be condemned. Christ used a lot loftier terms than Burke did. He also made it a lot more comprehensive, and it was given in a much more important fashion. And when you look at the Great Commission, you say, go. Well, that is what Edmund Burke was saying to mankind when he said, if good men do nothing, good men should do something. When the Great Commission, good men go, don't they? Or the word doesn't get spread. The Great Commission talks about salvation, talks about condemnation. Burke covered that. He said the triumph of evil is what we're looking at. We want to avoid, without the Great Commission and good men doing what Christ said, we have a triumph of condemnation for eternity. Can't get much more evil than that. The good that men could do, of course, is to bring salvation to those when they bring the word to them. But after I finally found that, my frustration ended. I felt a little better about myself, because I thought, surely that ought to be in the Bible. I didn't think any more or less of Edmund Burke when I found that, but I did come to a reaffirmation that my belief, and I think most Christians believe, that the Bible is the starting and ending place in matters of philosophy and morality. Edmund Burke really didn't come up with anything new philosophically. Then, the next thing that happens is I come into another situation of just common, everyday observation. And I think many of you have this same experience. And I thought that it seems that good people, very good people, and sometimes people not so good, end up in a spiritual hole, or end up so far away from the center of where they should be. And they wake up and they wonder, how did I get there? How did this happen? And more often than not, it happens gradually, very slowly. I know it happens to me occasionally. On a day-to-day measurement, I can't see myself moving away from where I need to be, but the cumulative thing together, if you add it all up, there's a danger of a gradual, I call it drifting, gradual drifting. And maybe it's because of the nature of my business that I see that so often. That good people will wake up, say, how did I get where I am? And if they analyze it, it didn't happen overnight. It wasn't where they went to bed Monday night, things were well, and they woke up Tuesday, everything was awful. It's a gradual drift. And I thought about that, and I thought, I know the Bible treats that. I know the Bible addresses that. So I started, did the drill again. You know, go to the first version or translation I've got and go to the concordance. And I look for the word gradual. You know, the word gradual is not in the Bible. I think I invented the word. I call this process where we just a little at a time can separate ourselves. I call that gradualism. I'm convinced I invented that word unknowingly. That's not in the Bible. Look in the dictionary. Gradualism is not in the Bible. But in my parlance, I was going to make it be there. I just knew that had to be there because that's such an important thing. And I see it affecting so many of us. Gradually drifting away, away. And then we wake up and see how far we are. How did I get here from there? How did I move so far from the center? And if those problems don't start off as a spiritual problem, they end up that way more often than not. They seem to begin maybe as financial problems or health problems or relationship problems. But whatever the source, they find themselves drifting slowly, slowly, slowly. I looked up the word drifting. Gradualism. I'm going into severe frustration again. The Bible doesn't treat this. And it should, I would think. We all know what that concept is of the danger of a little at a time. No big difference from one day to the next, but the gradual aspect starts to add up, and then we find ourselves that we've dug a hole for ourselves. Then, after I did the drill, and I don't know how long that went on again, thumbing through translations and thumbing through versions and concordances, I think I wore out a Knaves Topical Bible. It was no help. But I was using the wrong words. I finally found the scripture, Ephesians 4. You've been very patient waiting this long for us to get to the lesson of the hour. You'll find it in Ephesians 4th chapter. And when I finally found what I was looking for there, my search picked up speed. Paul, in Ephesians 4, is talking to the church at Ephesus and explaining to those Christians that they should not end up like the sinful Gentiles. And he nails the thought I was looking for in verse 19 when he says, having lost all sensitivity, key word being sensitivity here, they have given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity with continual lust for more. Sensitivity was the key word that I'd been looking for. The King James uses a phrase called being past feelings. I think maybe King James does a better job there. Give us the notion that we have lost our sensitivity. The sinning Gentiles had lost their sensitivity. We as Christians, faithful Christians, have a sensitivity to maintain. We should not be past feelings. Acts 28 and verse 27, I think, maybe uses a word that I think relates to this same subject. And the writer actually draws it from Isaiah 6 chapter when he says, for this people's heart has become calloused. That's probably the word that we're most familiar with biblically. When we lose our sensitivity or we get past the feelings that we should maintain as a Christian. If you've had calluses, you know what I'm talking about. If you know people who have had calluses and shook hands with them or been around them, you know what I'm talking about. They're good for the hands, but calluses are bad for the mind and the heart. You don't go to bed on Monday night without calluses and wake up Tuesday morning with calluses, do you? They'll do away with the sensitivity of your hands, but it takes time. Gradual, little at a time, every day, friction on the hands to grow a callus. The sensitivity that we as Christians have and can lose is lost gradually, little at a time, from one day to the next. It's probably not discernible, but you add up the cumulative effect and we become calloused or insensitive and no longer have the sensitivity that Christians should maintain. As Christians, and as we must maintain our sensitivity to a lot of things around us, we can get to the point where we can, of course, be so aloof and so far off. We don't belong there. We don't belong with this person. We don't belong with these people. And we need to maintain also a sensitivity of those people. I think that this notion of sensitivity works both ways. It tells us or shows us what to avoid, but it also tells us what to do because of other people's sensitivities. Do you want to be evangelistic and do more harm than good and do it real fast? And it's easy to do if we overlook what Paul was trying to tell us in Galatians 6, verse 1, about a type of sensitivity when he says, "Brothers, if someone is caught in a sin, you who are spiritual should restore him gently." So here we are as Christians worried about maintaining our sensitivity to the world, because if we lose it, we'll become just like those that we shouldn't emulate. But at the same time, we've got to also be very sensitive with those that we don't want to emulate. How do Christians avoid this, as I call it, gradual drift? And that's a phrase you won't find in the Bible. I never found it. But for my parlance, it conveys what I'm trying to say. How do we avoid this gradual drift that's easy to fall into? After I got to Ephesians 4, picked up speed, I finally got on the right track in search for a gradual drift verse. I was searching from the wrong end of it. Really, I should have been thinking about not gradual movement away from the center, but no movement at all. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58. "Therefore, my dear brothers, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord." Galatians 15, 1. "It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, and do not let yourselves be burdened again by yoke of slavery." Philippians 1:27, "Whatever happens, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then, whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I will know that you stand firm in one spirit, contending as one man for the faith of the gospel." Peter weighs in on this motion at 1 Peter 5 and 9. "Resist him," he's referring to the devil, "resist the devil, standing firm in the faith." 2 Peter 3 and 17. "Therefore, dear friends, since you already know this, be on your guard so that you may not be carried away by the error of lawless men." So the notion of don't drift from the center because of your loss of your sensitivities, the Bible really tells us stand firm. Those are mutually exclusive words. I don't think you can stand firm and drift at the same time. You can only do one or the other. Well, while we as Christians take this lofty position of standing firm and letting the rest of the world make its mistakes, but we're going to be very righteous, etc., which we should try to be, then of course we get to look down on the rest of the world, don't we? Well, of course not. And we've got scripture that's very sobering and reminds us of what we're to do there. Romans 12:17, provide things honest in the sight of all men. That's King James. NIV at Romans 12:17 says, be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody. There's an aspect there that no matter how firm we stand, no matter how close to the center we stay, no matter whether if we never drift gradually away, we're still to look good in the eyes of everybody. And I think that's very possible by the things we say, do, and what we choose in our actions. Romans 12:16 tells us, while we're to stand firm, verse 16 says, do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. And as you process through all those scriptures on how we're to maintain certain sensitivities and use them to help others, we find that we have a fine line to walk, don't we, as a Christian? I mean, you've got to stay centered or avoid the gradual drift, as I'm calling it. Must stand firm, but at the same time, make yourself known and noticed to those of low estate, as the King James says. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody. We don't have to act like we are some weird, strange person because of our position of standing firm. There's a fine line to walk. And I'm not sure that it's an easy one, but we have plenty of scriptures that tell us how to walk that line and where to put it. We're not to be harsh with the world, but be sensitive to the wrong paths and continue to stand firm. The Florida Department of Corrections is the third largest Department of Corrections in the United States. They have 128 prisons to administer, 85,000 inmates. And in the year 2006, they had a complete meltdown. You may have picked up on this in the news. The Florida Department of Corrections imploded in the year 2006. It got so bad that they had 40 of their high officials charged with crimes. Corruption, embezzlement, abuse of prisoners were most of the charges on these 40 officials. They had 90 people fired in the system, and 280 that they kept were demoted. And the Florida Department of Corrections, or what was left of it, called in James McDonough, who was an expert in prison reform, and said, clean up this mess that we have. And he did, and he wrote a report. His report was most interesting on how much damage can be done by slow, gradual change or drift, or failing to stand firm. His report, in part, said one of the most principal elements of the failure of the prison system was a softball team. A softball team. Don't get me wrong. Softball is a great sport. If I could still play it, I would. I wish I was better at it than I ever was. Softball is a great sport. But it brought the Florida prison system down, or was the principal factor involved. How? How could that happen? Well, it was because if you wanted to get promoted in the Florida Department of Corrections, you had to be a good softball player. And I imagine they had a good softball team. If you wanted to get hired into the Department of Corrections, if you could hit the long ball, hit a home run, you could get hired in the Florida Department of Corrections. And if you kept your batting average up, you could get promoted in the Florida Department of Corrections. And that started as a very slow, gradual thing. Nobody saw it coming. It developed over a long period of time. And then all at once, they woke up and their department had imploded and had to be completely overhauled of those that didn't go to the penitentiary. Again, showing the danger of the slow, gradual drift or movement that can occur over a period of time, not discernible one day at a time until you look at the cumulative effect of all of it, and then it can be devastating. This gradual drift or growing insensitivity, whatever label you want to put on it, can affect us a lot in our personal habits, in the type of recreation that we choose to pursue, and the type of people that we seek for companionship. It can creep up on us a little at a time, slowly. And, you know, when we hear of a, occasionally we hear of a congregation in the brotherhood that launches off into uncharted paths, they get off base, and you know how heartbreaking that is to so many people. And we see that the same gradual drift occurs there. That didn't happen overnight when that happens with a congregation. It happens over a long period of time, but a very small movement from day to day. Well, how do you avoid that small movement? You know, we've never had that kind of a problem here, and I'm thankful for that. But how do you stop things like that from happening? It's simple. 1 Corinthians 15, stand firm. Galatians 5:1, stand firm. Philippians 1:27, stand firm. 1 Peter 5:9, standing firm. 2 Peter 3, don't be carried away by the error of lawless men and fall from your secure position. So it's there. It's all there in the Scripture. You've got to be a little smarter than I am and choose your words right when you look for it, or you will waste a lot of time. But the message is there clearly in our personal lives, those about us, all of our friends, all of our relatives, that we've got to watch the slow, gradual drift, don't we, in our lives, or it can, over a period of time, really affect us. Or in Bible words, simply, stand firm. One of the best lessons I think I ever heard on this was from a father who was casually talking to his daughter. She wanted to go take a friend to a party who had to go for one reason or another. I forget the particulars. She said, "Dad, I don't want to go. I don't want to go to that. But I've got to take so-and-so because she has to go. And I'm not going to like what's going on there, etc." And her dad said, "No, I don't want you going." And she said, "Well, all right, but give me a good reason." He said, "You will lose your sensitivity. If you go to one and what they're doing there, you'll be around, you will lose your sensitivity. You'll become insensitive over a period of time. Maybe not once, but it'll make it easier the second time to indulge in that. And the first thing you know, your sensitivity is gone." And I think that's what Paul was referring to in Ephesians 4:19. As Christians, let's maintain our sensitivity to those types of things. If there's anyone here tonight that has studied the Bible to the extent that you want to become a Christian, we always, when we congregate, extend an invitation to you, because we think that's the most important decision a person can make, and we want to afford you that opportunity tonight to come forward. If you want to become a Christian tonight, we encourage you with this invitation song.